From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Of all the many moving parts of the ongoing Great Recession, the part that really chips away at our collective confidence is the one that puts people out on the street, literally. It's the foreclosure crisis. You could tell that story with statistics.
More than 288,000 properties were lost to foreclosure in the July-September quarter. That's up from nearly
1 in 5 homeowners now in some sort of trouble. 1 in 5.
But now that crisis has deepened into a full-blown scandal.
Attorneys general from across the country are expected to investigate allegations that some banks use fraudulent paperwork to kick struggling borrowers out of their
homes. You have banks sending people to change the locks on houses that aren't in foreclosure. You have all sorts of craziness.
J.P. Morgan Chase has now admitted they made a mistake.
They're intoxicated with power, and it's wild. It's the Wild West.
Turns out that many big mortgage companies lack the proper paperwork to foreclose and may have done so in error. Advocacy groups and some Democrats have called for a national moratorium on foreclosures, but the top Dem in the White House opposes it. Should you blame the borrower or blame the lender be? According to a recent Rasmussen poll, public opinion on everything from who to blame to how to proceed is mostly divided. What if the crisis were more thoroughly illustrated? In the mid-1930s, Franklin Roosevelt's Farm Security Administration, or FSA, hired a couple dozen photographers to help the public fathom the impact of the Great Depression. Among the now famous names doing that work were Walker Evans, Gordon Parks, and Dorothea Lange. But has the economic crisis of our time, the housing crisis, yielded a similarly inspired photojournalism, a kind that transcends the politics and confronts us with the uncomfortable consequences? Paul Reyes, author of Exiles in Eden, Life Among the Ruins of Florida's Great Recession, explored that question in a recent New York Times blog post in which he examined what's been called foreclosure photography. He says that to understand the power of images to tell these stories, we need only look back to Dorothea Lange's iconic photograph called Migrant Mother.
That's a classic picture where the migrant mother is looking off into the distance, hand on her face, and her two children with their tousled hair are looking away.
There is some debate over how that picture came to look the way that it does.
Sure. And this speaks to the nature of photography in general. I mean, there are test rolls for Lange's session with Miss Thompson. Florence Thompson is her name, the migrant mother. And there are dozens of shots. And she picked the shot that best articulated her message about the suffering caused by the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression and the economic conditions of the time. There are other shots where the kids are laughing, she's smiling. And so whatever Lange had to do to create the shot, it was effective as far as its message is concerned.
So do you see some sort of analogy in today's foreclosure photography? First of all, what is that?
Foreclosure photography?
Mm-hmm.
A photographer either documenting a family losing their home or entering a home and photographing that home. You know, when I started my career as a writer in 1998, one of the jobs I had before was to work for my father, who cleaned out and repaired these houses. We call them trash outs. And during that process, part of the job is to document the work ahead for the bank, what you're going to do, how much it's going to cost. And my father would go around snapping pictures with a little plastic disposable camera. And amid all this junk that was eventually going to be taken to the dump, you could piece a life together.
You describe in your Times post a number of photographers and their different approaches or philosophies, for lack of a better word. It seems like perhaps your philosophy is closest to that of David H. Wells, who's careful not to include people in his photographs.
Yeah, Wells, he's adamant. In interviewing him, he mentioned that if he includes human portraits, then it becomes too specific and not universal, and that by photographing the spaces, there is a tendency for the viewer to place him or herself in that space and to empathize.
Can you deconstruct one of his photographs?
Well, my favorite, of course, all these photographs require, or at least a good number of them require, some kind of backstory. And the backstory behind this one, he entered a home that had been foreclosed upon. The owners weren't there, of course, but they'd left quite a bit of stuff. And one of the things that they left were hundreds of these karate trophies that apparently a son had won. And what was startling to him is that he realized they detached all of the nameplates that listed first place, second place, third place, so that he had at least some token of his accomplishment. And that backstory fleshes that photograph out.
Are there pictures that work without backstories?
I think for most of photography, you have to bring something to it. You can appreciate the photograph aesthetically, but the context gives it its power. The photographers I mention in this piece, one is Todd Heido, and Todd's photographs are from 1998, and they're all of empty rooms, almost completely empty. Eerie pictures, and he got lucky every now and then and captured this beautiful light, which in the dankness, he was able to juxtapose two qualities, this aesthetic beauty, but also this loneliness. And in Heido's photographs, all of the human presence remains in these gestures, whether it's a half-closed door or whether it's the impression of a bed. And when he was presenting these photographs in 1998, people didn't know what they were. They didn't know what a foreclosure was. And only now do people bring a level of empathy that wasn't there before, because it's much closer.
One of the photographers that you discussed that takes a very different approach is Anthony Swa.
Swa has, I think, the most holistic approach to this crisis. He's photographed Wall Street bankers. He's photographed sheriff deputies entering a foreclosure, people getting evicted, that sort of thing. And they're densely populated, both with the houses of East Cleveland, which is his main turf, and with the individuals themselves. In fact, one of my favorite pictures by Swa is in this one neighborhood, which has just been ravaged by foreclosures and abandonment. People have turned these foreclosures into works of art. They have painted over the plywood that covers the windows and the doors. They've painted scenes of a cat on a stoop or flowers on the windowsill, that sort of thing. And it's those gestures that speak loudly to a human component.
You mentioned photographers like John Francis Peters, who photographs the interiors of foreclosed homes and is very careful not to disturb surroundings. It's important for him to capture the rooms exactly as he finds them. And then as a counterpoint, there's T.J. Preschel, who takes a very different approach.
Sometimes it's extraordinary to find what you find in some of these houses. And there's one photograph by Preschel that is part of his foreclosure series where he didn't touch a thing. And it's like a David Lynch still. I mean, there's a tanning bed and liquor bottles and a hatchet and a teddy bear.
A dwarf.
Yeah, exactly. But for most of his pictures, Preschel takes what's in a room and arranges it so that it fits a frame. So, for instance, there's one picture where he found, you know, the rock on the floor, the shattered glass around it, and the plywood that's covering up the broken window. And in fact, the other thing that's in the frame naturally next to the rock is a pile of televisions for some reason. But what he brings into the frame is the chair and the cowboy hats and the portrait of a daughter. By doing that, he's not only able to present this story, but also give the house some kind of personality. John Francis Peters, on the other hand, doesn't touch a thing. He just walks in and tries to capture what he calls the energy of the space. And in doing so, has these marvelous photographs that you need to sort of spend some time with, because aesthetically they're pleasing, but there really isn't anything dramatic about them, whether it's of a blue couch with a toy keyboard set neatly on one end of it, or this Mylar balloon from a birthday party that has lost enough air to sort of float and skim the ground. Only by looking at it forensically is the story able to surface, and the humanity of the picture and the humanity of the room is able to surface.
You know, these pictures remind me a little bit of the pictures that were taken after Katrina in the Ninth Ward, the fronts of houses sheared away, and you saw a whole life, like a dollhouse, with all the innards exposed.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because while I was an editor at the Oxford American Magazine, I remember seeing a number of these photography collections. And while it isn't quite fair to line up the circumstances because they're not the same, aesthetically, there became this sad trend in disaster photography, beginning with pictures of Ground Zero, Joel Meyerowitz's operatic book, Aftermath. And then you had Robert Polidori's photographs of Katrina, and you had Chris Jordan's portraits of the houses of Katrina. And now you have Ed Bertinsky's landscapes of the oil spill in the Gulf, which are beautiful, beautiful pictures, but haunting at the same time.
And so where does the foreclosure photography fit in?
Of all the recessions that have come and gone, there aren't that many that can be visually articulated. You have the Depression, you have the oil crisis of the 1970s. You have the ubiquitous image of the Wall Street broker looking at the ticker, which from what I can tell originates with Black Monday 1987. And then you have this, the foreclosure crisis. And certainly this is more powerful than anything that has happened since the Depression. If there's an iconic image among them that history will keep, it remains to be seen, I guess.
You have a candidate?
While it may not be fair to say that his is the best photography, Bruce Gilden's work is very interesting. And what Gilden has done through Magnum in Motion is to put together these multimedia presentations. You could argue that it's unfair to embellish the photograph with sound and music, that it just becomes a trailer for the crisis or some kind of music video. But I do think what he's doing may be one of the most visceral experiences in looking at these photographs, because it includes this very unsettling music, and not only the faces of people who are going through this, but the voices of people who are going through this. And they're very angry voices, and there's violence in those voices.
It's just another foreclosure and eviction situation. Foreclosure and eviction is spiritually wrong. Yeah. After they throw you out your lifetime home, your lifetime home, things are going to get worse.
It's a disturbing thing to watch. And I think because of the combination of technologies and the combination of media, that might be pushing the envelope in a direction that I think will be fascinating to witness in the next few years. Because obviously, in many ways, this is just beginning.
Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Paul Reyes is author of Exiles in Eden, Life Among the Ruins of Florida's Great Recession.
What's happening in America?
Coming up, a cavalcade of unauthorized disclosures. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, NPR analyst Juan Williams became former NPR analyst Juan Williams after the network fired him for comments he made on the O'Reilly Factor earlier in the week. NPR said that Williams's comments were, quote, inconsistent with their editorial standards and practices. Here's what Williams said.
I'm not a bigot. You know, the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous. Now, I remember also that when that Times Square bomber was at court, I think this is just last week, he said the war with Muslims, America's war with Muslims, is just beginning. First drop of blood. I don't think there's any way to get away from these facts.
That specific clip of tape was circulated by a liberal blog called Think Progress, and it hopped from liberal blog to liberal blog until it was swiftly picked up by the mainstream media, and that's when Williams got axed. The firing has probably been worse for NPR than it has for Williams. Some Republicans are calling for the network to be defunded, while Fox has offered the former NPR analyst a $2 million contract. Whatever the upshot, Slate's Will Salatin thinks that Williams shouldn't have been fired. He says that Williams' admitted fear of Muslims on planes was meant to set up a more nuanced point, one that you don't get to hear in the edited clip.
Williams goes on to put that in a larger context. He says, this is my visceral feeling. I have this reaction. But he goes on to say,
but I think there are people who want to somehow remind us all, as President Bush did after 9/11, it's not a war against Islam.
If I can draw a larger point, I think he's saying this is something for the whole country to get over. If you look at polling data, if you look at the uproar over the proposed Islamic Center in New York, we obviously have a problem with fear of Muslims in this country. Fear of Muslims driving a lot of what people are saying. And I think it's probably important that we acknowledge it at the same time that we're trying to overcome it.
The other big point you make in your piece is that Williams was indisputably a victim of selective editing. What are people who have been exposed to the Think Progress tape not hearing?
Well, it's very similar. Those of you who've heard the Shirley Sherrod video.
She's the Agriculture Department official who was speaking before the NAACP and was wildly taken out of context by the right-wing blogosphere. She was confronting her own sort of racial stereotyping when sitting with a white farmer who was seeking assistance, and she was initially inclined not to help him. Of course, she saw the error of her ways, and that was the point of her story. That point was completely eliminated. People only got the setup, and she was fired by the White House.
That's right. And so if you saw the Think Progress clip, you saw something very similar. You saw a short video excerpt. If they were to let it run for a split second longer, he said, but I think there are people who want to somehow remind us all, as President Bush did after 9/11, it's not a war against Islam. And then Williams goes on to say several other things, that we shouldn't draw conclusions about all Christians from the actions of Timothy McVeigh.
That was an interesting exchange. I'd like to play that.
Because if you said, well, Timothy McVeigh, the Atlanta bomber, these people who are protesting against homosexuality at military funerals, very obnoxious, you don't say first and foremost, we got a problem with Christians.
Because
that's crazy.
But it's not at that level.
He's trying to say, look, if you can't identify with Muslims in this context, you know, let's analogize to Christians, because this is something that a lot of conservatives find easy, the idea of anti-Christian bigotry. We all can recognize it. And so how would you feel if someone were to draw conclusions about all Christians from Timothy McVeigh? Obviously, would upset you. I viewed that as a kind of pedagogical exchange with O'Reilly, in which Williams is saying, here is a context in which you might be able to draw the lesson that I'm trying to teach you.
But then O'Reilly asks Juan, who's posing a problem in Germany?
Is it the Muslims who have come there or the Germans?
Absolutely.
Who's causing the problem?
No, wait. You see, you did it again. It's extremists. It's people who refuse to assimilate into German society.
He's saying focus on the extremism, focus on the terrorism itself. And that's pretty much the lesson that we all need to draw.
He also seems to offer a caution to O'Reilly for his own rhetoric.
The other day in New York, some guy cuts a Muslim cabbie's neck and says he's attacking him. Yeah. I don't know what's in that guy's head, but I'm saying we don't want in America people to have their rights violated, to be attacked on the street because they hear rhetoric from Bill O'Reilly and they act crazy.
He is saying, I had this reaction. We should treat people fairly. We should not discriminate on the basis of religion. And we should be very wary of what we say on the air. And I guess what really saddens me is I wonder how many people just saw the Think Progress clip, not the whole video, and so think that Juan Williams was encouraging some sort of violence when he was saying precisely the opposite.
What about the attacks on NPR by the right-wing blogosphere, which says, okay, now it's showing its true colors. All it cares about is political correctness.
I don't think it is affirmatively true that that's sort of what motivated, but I do think that it's easier to overlook things when you have a certain view of the world or when you have a certain sensibility. Racism immediately stands out to you. Anti-Muslim bigotry stands out to you. So do I think he got fired for being some ideological thing? No, I don't think so, but I wouldn't dismiss that a certain annoyance at some things that he has said may have been in the background and influenced it.
Back in 2009, he said of Michelle Obama, she's got this Stokely Carmichael in a designer dress thing going. You know, I think this would all have been a lot easier if NPR had examined Juan Williams' remarks that weren't taken out of context and just decided whether or not they wanted to renew his contract earlier.
Well, I think we'd be having a completely different conversation, you and I and the whole political blogosphere, if NPR had said, look, we have a longstanding issue with Juan Williams, and not about any particular comment, but over the course of his career, and we don't feel this is appropriate. But for whatever reason, they chose to single out this incident, thinking, I think, that it would be the most politically expedient case to make their point that he's gone off the deep end, as they see it. And I think they picked the wrong case. I think they picked the wrong case to make their case against Juan Williams, and I think they picked the wrong case to make a point against anti-Muslim bigotry.
Will, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Will Salatin is a columnist for Slate. We called NPR. No one was available for comment. But in an email sent Thursday to NPR member stations, NPR President Vivian Schiller did suggest that Williams was not fired on the basis of a single remark. Quote, we offer views of all kinds on your air every day, but those views are expressed by those we interview, not our reporters and analysts. She went on, this isn't the first time we have had serious concerns about some of Juan's public comments. Despite many conversations and warnings over the years, Juan has continued to violate this principle. Roy
Reuters Breaking Views, a financial news website owned by the Reuters Wire Service, announced this week that it had launched an internal investigation of some of its journalists who had apparently invested in the securities they were reporting on. One of those journalists has already resigned. The allegations, if true, are bad. It's hard to imagine how having a financial stake would not, even unconsciously, influence your reporting. Would disclosure resolve the conflict of interest conundrum? Dan Gross covers business and economic issues for Yahoo Finance. He says that for mainstream media outlets, disclosure is not the preferred option. They stipulate that most reporters who cover the market simply should not invest in it.
Yeah, you are generally prohibited from having a Schwab account that you are trading for yourself, although I guess they can't stop your spouse or an uncle for doing that for you. And I think in many ways, you can argue that that's sort of ridiculous because, you know, when you have a mutual fund or an index fund, you in effect own Apple and Google and every single stock.
Yeah, but I mean, if you judged purity by that standard, you'd really be up a creek because even if you don't own any stock at all, the company that employs you probably owns a bunch of other companies.
Absolutely. So if you work for the Wall Street Journal, you work for News Corp, which also owns the Fox News Channel and movie studios and all sorts of other businesses that they are constantly covering. And when they do that, they make a disclosure. They say, you know, our parent company owns this other company.
Which brings me back to the first question. Why not simply disclose and direct readers to a website where it's listed? Just put it out there somewhere.
Well, I think old habits die very hard in our industry. And there's been this divide between personal finance journalism, just telling people what to do with their money, and covering the news of corporate America. In personal finance journalism, it is perfectly acceptable for the people who are writing and giving advice to own shares and be trading them. In fact, that's part of the idea. But where somebody is covering an industry or they're covering a particular company, you could see why you would want a blanket prohibition on people trading or owning shares of those types of companies, because their news has the ability to move the market. And once you have the ability to do that, then you have the ability to profit on a move in the market. When I think you're dealing with people writing about the culture of money or economic news or big trends like globalization, that prohibition doesn't make sense because there's really very little you can do that will move the market.
So what do you do for a living?
I'm the economics editor and a columnist at Yahoo Finance.
So you do global, you do national, you do...
I write about individual companies when it makes sense. I write
so
about economic trends.
Waterfront. All over,
yes.
What stocks do you own?
I'd rather not say.
Seriously?
Yeah. We invest for our kids' college education through these 529 plans. We invest in our 401k through index funds or mutual funds, and that's largely it.
Do you think that the public has a right to know what you invest in?
The public has a right to know that the journalist who is covering a certain company is not trading in those shares. But that presumption is implicit and embedded.
It's embedded in a code of journalistic ethics, which is currently very much in flux in a new media environment.
It's embedded in the code of journalistic ethics, but also in the policies of the employers. A blogger who's on their own and self-employed and covering the markets and they're writing about stuff and they're saying, you know, I own this stock and here's what I think of it. There's no problem with that. When you are bringing in the brand of your parent company, and your parent company is the New York Times or Yahoo, and what that brand stands for is unbiased information, not giving stock market advice, that becomes a much bigger issue.
The best way to address this issue of conflict of interest is to keep mum or to just disclose yourself to the world and then prove by your journalism it's not an issue.
The onus, I think, is on the journalists and the journalistic organizations to maintain their standards, ensure that those standards aren't violated, and prove that their work is clean and above suspicion, rather than to say, just so you don't think anything is fishy, I own 100 shares of Apple and 200 shares of IBM, and my mother day trades solar company stocks all day. I mean, you know, where does it end?
Dan, thank you very much.
Oh, I have one disclosure. Last time I was here, Bob Garfield sold me 1,000 shares of WNYC. And I was just curious if there's an active market for those and if I could trade them.
Did he sell you a chunk of the Brooklyn Bridge, too? Dan Gross is economics editor and columnist for Yahoo Finance.
So maybe we don't like the idea that internet news sites and social network sites intrude on our privacy and collect our data. We nevertheless do like that those sites are free, and they're free because they make money selling our data. But now there's something else to dislike, a process called data scraping, whereby third-party companies use automated software to try and scrape our information from our favorite sites and internet forums and even resume sites like Monster.com. And the scrapers offer no free service in exchange for that data. Our information is just swiped. Julia Angwin, senior technology editor for The Wall Street Journal, has written about data scraping. Julia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, could you start with the opening anecdote in your piece earlier this month? Tell us what happened on May 7th.
There's a website called Patients Like Me, and patients with a whole host of different diseases, ranging from really serious terminal cancer to depression, gather to talk about their experiences with their disease and talk about the drugs they're using. On May 7th at 1 a.m., a new member joined the Mood Forum, which is a place where people talk about pretty serious depression, and started cutting and pasting all the posts from that forum. This turned out to be a robot. They traced the scraping to Nielsen Company, which is most people know them as their TV rating service, but they also have a service called Buzz Monitoring, where they, quote, listen to the conversations on the web and tell their clients how are they being talked about. So their clients include all of the top pharmaceutical companies. But Nielsen, since they were caught doing it, they said that they weren't going to use the data.
How is the data that's been scraped most often used?
Well, the thing about scraping is that it can be legitimate. In some ways, what Google does when it searches the web to make its index of links is a kind of scraping. But there are people out there trying to get every single different type of data. So Nielsen is trying to, quote, listen to conversations and monitor them. Then you have companies that are trying to build up their databases about individuals. So they might be looking for your name and address so they can put it on some mailing list for junk mail, or there might be a spammer who's trying to get your email address. So the world of scrapers is an unruly one, and it ranges from completely legitimate to completely illegitimate.
What about legal recourse? Is there any?
There are three different ways you can fight against a scraper. You can allege that they've stolen copyrighted material. You can allege essentially that they've trespassed on your property. If you're the website owner, your website is sort of your property. And you can also allege that they've broken a contract. So if they click, you know, those little things where it says, I agree, and you there's some
terms
long
of
list
service
of thing that you never read. If they clicked that in order to get into an area of the site and that said no scraping, then they can also allege. So there are a lot of cases, but the problem is that the rulings have been contradictory. Sometimes courts have said, you know, it's not really trespass because you actually want people to come to your website. So you can't choose which people you want.
The data scrapers definitely come off as the bad guys in your piece. But as you note, Google engages in a kind of data scraping. What's the harm?
I mean, the case with Patients Like Me is a perfect example, right? Where you feel like you're safe. You've entered some CAPTCHA, you've joined an account, you've signed some terms of service. And then if some scraper breaks in, steals all that and puts it up for sale, it feels like a violation.
But it's still all public information, right? I mean, if we found our way to Patients Like Me, then so can anyone else. There's no lock on the door. That's the nature of the web.
It used to be that if you were sitting alone in your house, basically everything you did was automatically private. But now we basically have these transmission lines where things you do while you're sitting alone and you feel like you're alone are actually going out into the universe instantaneously in real time before you have a chance to sort of have a second thought about maybe that wasn't a good idea to hit post. And so now we have to decide as a society what kind of world do we want to live in. Like, shouldn't we have takedown notices for our own data? You know, Warner Music can go and get a takedown notice for any video that has their song in it.
Some might say, look, you don't have to use your real name, and yet there's this company called PQ LLC, which has just applied for a patent that would use information about you that's scattered all over the web to match your real name with whatever pseudonym you might use on a place like Twitter. Does that presage the end of internet anonymity?
There's a world of people out there who sell data about individuals, and every additional piece of data they can get means they can put a higher price tag. So for them, the effort it takes to match your Twitter name or your MySpace name, which you think is anonymous, that's a business opportunity, and they're going to pursue it.
In this chaotic internet ecosystem where there's more value to a targeted ad than there may be to a 30-second broadcast commercial, isn't this just part of the natural evolution of the commercial, which supports most of the free media that we love?
It may be that the future of advertising is that every ad says your name in it and they know everything about you. That would be, I think, the dream of a lot of advertisers. The question is it a dream for us as consumers? I worry, though, about a world where everything is known about you, so all you see reflected back is yourself. Where's the serendipity? Isn't that the nature of going on the internet, is to find out about the rest of the world? So I worry about that, that you would live in a hall of mirrors.
Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia Angwin is the senior technology editor for WallStreetJournal.com. Coming up, why do Germans hate Google Street View? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a little something extra for you, our listeners. We've just launched a new animated series in which Bob and I snarkily comment on this season's political ads, Mystery Science Theater style. It's called Media Scrutiny Theater 2010, or MST 2010. And we're doing it in collaboration with WNYC's new political website, itsafreecountry.org. Here's our take on Kentucky Democrat Jack Conway's negative ad against Rand Paul.
Why was Rand Paul a member of a secret society that called the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned for mocking Christianity and Christ?
Why was Rand Paul a dumbass college kid? Why?
Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his God was Aqua Buddha?
He worships an aftershave?
Why does Rand Paul now want to end all federal faith-based initiatives and even end the deduction for religious charities?
Is this guy running for U.S. Senate or for church deacon? What's Paul's Christianity got to do with anything?
Why are there so many questions about Rand Paul?
Because you hired Mr. Scary Voice to ask them.
To see how it looks, just go to itsafreecountry.org or to the On the Media Facebook page. Those of you eager to see the 20 German cities that Google says will appear on Street View, its photo mapping service, may be a little disappointed. The company gave Germans the chance to blur out their properties before German Street View launches this year. And this week we learned that 244,000 households, or nearly 3% of homes, will be blurred. There have been several dust-ups around the globe over Street View, which now allows users to get a sidewalk perspective of 32 countries. But opposition to the service seems to be stiffest in Germany, where Google has been in turbulent negotiations with privacy regulators for 2 years. Reporter Michael Bernstein traveled to Germany to look behind the scenes of that country's privacy concerns.
A ponytailed teacher dressed in black stands in front of a classroom of 10th graders in the small central German city of Mainz. He asks them to look up their names online, discusses their social networking habits, and directs them to an ominous-looking website called whattheinternetknowsaboutyou.com. This is internet privacy education, a growing trend in Germany, and at least in this classroom, the lesson seems to be taking.
Do you speak English a little bit?
A little bit.
What's your name?
Yes, it's private.
In a country where hanging out in the park naked is a weekend pastime, Germany has recently made international headlines for its virtual prudishness. American tech companies are under close scrutiny. Facebook was threatened with fines if it didn't tighten its privacy controls. Apple's iPhone 4 raised concerns over collection of user data. And then, of course, there was that enormous brouhaha over Google Street View.
Er will Lücken in Google Street View schließen.
Das Problem mit den Google Street View Bildern.
Nach dem Start von Street View in Deutschland weitergehen.
What makes Germany particularly important for these companies is its size and wealth. With 82 million people, it has the largest economy in Europe. But Germans care more than most about what happens to their data. This may sound like your run-of-the-mill Berlin rave, but it's actually the Freedom Not Fear demonstration. Thousands of people come together every year to protest government and corporate surveillance online. Protesters carry signs saying things like, 1984 is now, and keep your hands off my data. Carolyn Geller was among the marchers.
We have the feeling that we are watched from everywhere. We just want to express that we don't say yes to that. It's like this ominous thing, and you don't know really what is done with it.
Germany's data protection movement has had a storied history. In the 80s, there was a public outcry when the West German government tried to take a census. Many citizens felt like it was too intrusive and sued. Germany's constitutional court ruled the census was unconstitutional because it violated the right to informational self-determination. The decision was based on the belief that people are not free unless they know that data from one part of their life won't leak into another.
As I'm sitting here, I'm talking to you as a scientist. Yeah? But at the same time, I'm a tango dancer.
Law professor and tango dancer Garrett Arung is an example of a man who doesn't want his lives to intermingle.
If I'm going tango dancing, people may be frightened if they know that I'm a lawyer. People tend to not like that. So I have a personal interest to separate these two roles. Yeah? And so this is one example of reasoning which the court tried to build into the judgment.
Aware of the court's dim view of privacy intrusions, when Google announced Street View's national rollout, it not only gave Germans the right to opt their homes and businesses out, but it also launched a massive media campaign to assure the public that other privacy controls, like the blurring out of faces and license plates, are also part of Street View. Still, recent surveys have found that anywhere from 16 to more than 50% of people don't want their homes on the service. Google Germany spokesman Kay Oberbeck.
Definitely one of the reasons we see why privacy is really a sensitive topic is the history of two totalitarian regimes here in Germany.
The Nazi regime was notorious for scrupulous data collection, and the Stasi, the East German secret police, was so pervasive that some estimate that it ultimately involved 1/6 of the population. But for many Germans, the concern has less to do with a totalitarian past and more to do with their socioeconomic future. Berlin Data Protection and Freedom of Information Commissioner Alexander Dix should know. He fields many calls from Germans angry about Street View.
I can perfectly understand people who say, I do object to it, and I want to have a right to prevent Street View publishing such pictures, because the house, the car in front of the house, or the way in which I keep my front garden orderly or disorderly is something which tells something about me. Employers may be looking at the vicinity in which you live. Banks may be looking at this information in order to score your credit application to decide whether you will be likely to repay your debts.
In an Italian restaurant in a quiet Hamburg neighborhood, a group of apartment house tenants gathered to discuss whether to blur their building on Google Street View.
The apartment is my private sphere, and I know that it is a safe room for me, where I can behave as I want to, without thinking about outside influences. Perhaps Google Street View takes that from me.
Why aren't the Americans worried? From an American perspective, it's of course somehow logical to say, why are you thinking about it so much? But for me, this also raises the question of why they aren't thinking about it.
Germans tend to understand their privacy interests very differently from the way Americans understand their privacy interests. The concept of privacy that we find in Europe has to do with the protection and control of one's image.
Yale Law School professor James Whitman says this idea has roots in Europe's legacy of dueling. When private details went public in the past, nobles challenged the leaker to a duel with a sword or pistol. An invasion of privacy, after all, was an attack on one's honor. Today in Germany, weapons have been replaced by strict privacy laws. And while many Germans may think the laws were made in reaction to their totalitarian past, in fact, Whitman says, quite the contrary.
The Nazis insisted on the right of every ordinary German to protection of personal dignity, of personal honor. Privacy in the German sense. Every member of the national community had a right to dignity, including members of the lowest social status. The fact that fascists made this promise belonged to their competition with communist movements. What the Nazis were saying was that where they would not redistribute wealth, they would nevertheless redistribute honor.
Of course, this was done at the cost of persons whose honor was systematically destroyed by the Nazis in the most horrific way imaginable.
Nevertheless, there's a paradox. Ordinary low-status Germans acquired a right to protection of their personal honor during the Nazi period that they had barely enjoyed before the Nazi period, and this has continued down to this day.
Joachim Savelsberg, professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota, says German privacy concerns may also have to do with the country's Prussian roots.
In Prussia, being very much influenced by Lutheran thought with the two-kingdom theory, there's the world of public life, of the state, of markets, and then there's the private sphere where friendship, forgiveness, cozy relationships predominate.
Maybe this separation explains Germany's fondness for high hedges and thick drapes, whereas America is arguably more influenced by its Calvinist tradition.
And indeed, in Calvinism, there was not this separation between private sphere and public life, because the individual was much more perceived as someone whose every move was observed by God and who could not ever hide between a thick hedge. There was no protection against that big brother called God.
But today, it's the littler brothers that are worrying Germany. And it's not just American tech companies. For instance, one man is planning to do a crowdsourcing project to take and post a picture of every building that's been blurred on the Street View map. Since there's no specific law that prohibits taking pictures of houses from the sidewalk, there's very little stopping him. Curbing anarchy on the net is hard. In front of the Brandenburg Gate, a lone saxophone is right on tune. Germany wants to do technology its own way. It wants innovations with limitations. But ultimately, even in Germany, the market will probably win out. Facebook, Apple, and Google search are all very popular. A German kid standing nearby tells me why he likes Street View.
Some people can fly to New York, and you can see the streets in New York, and that's cool.
Exactly. It's cool. In fact, Germans of all ages seem to love looking at the streets of other countries, which means they're very much in tune with at least one popular American notion, known in the United States as NIMBY. We love what you're doing, only not in my backyard. For On the Media, I'm Michael Bernstein.
Michael Bernstein's reporting was made possible by a McCloy Fellowship from the American Council on Germany. The phone book is a catalog of phone numbers, a metaphor for boredom, a booster seat, a doorstop, a punchline. Here's Steve Martin in The Jerk.
Nothing! Are you kidding? Kate 73! Johnson! Maven! R! I'm somebody now! Millions of people look at this book every day! This is the kind of spontaneous publicity, your name in print, that makes people!
Amin Shea is author of The Phone Book, the curious history of the book that everyone uses but no one reads. Welcome to On the Media.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you previously penned a book called Reading the OED, so you have a thing for reference books?
I do, in fact, have a certain bent for reference books, I'll admit it.
Why?
I think that they're underutilized. I think we only use reference books for the ostensible purpose for which they were printed, and they can really provide us with so much more. After I published a book about reading the dictionary, I started meeting people who came up to me and confessed that they like to read the train schedule. And at first, I really thought these people are obviously lunatics. And then one of them explained to me that what he does is say he'll have a train schedule from Paris to Istanbul or something. And he's not thinking, you know, Gare du Nord at 11:37 a.m. He's remembering the last time he was in Paris. He was remembering the last time he met an old lover at the Gare du Nord or something. And so this random assemblage of numbers and digits on a page suddenly becomes this wonderful, like, Proustian way of revisiting his past or his fantasies.
There have in the past been efforts to give the phone book a bit of literary flair.
There have. And I'm sorry to say most of them have not survived. In the 1990s, a fellow in Long Island named Rodney Ryan, who prints local yellow pages there, liked poetry. And so he would stick in little bits and pieces of poems next to the categories that he thought they would match with. So there was this beautiful Emily Dickinson line, "Until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names," about tombstones. And that went next to undertakers or something like that.
Certainly you needed to know where to find people before there were telephones. So there must have been proto-phone books,
well,
right?
Well, there were directories, city directories, before there were telephone directories. And the first one dates to 1665. It was in New Amsterdam, what's obviously now New York City. But if you look at the old ones, a lot of times they're terribly incomplete. And so they'll say things like William Johnson Carpenter, and that's it. And they don't say anything else about them. They're not terribly helpful. And regular directories and telephone directories coexisted for a number of years, and eventually telephone directories replaced the need for having another directory.
Early telephone books contained instructions. Phones were relatively new at the time, and so people had to be told how to use them. You quote from the New York City Telephone Directory, 1885. To call, press in the button and turn the crank once only. Unhook the listening telephone, that's the receiver, and put it close to your ear when central office will inquire what number, give central office and number of person wanted, and upon receiving the answer, all right, hang up receiver, wait till bell rings.
Sometimes these instructions would go on for a full page or a page and a half. They really wanted to make sure that everybody knew how to use this. And people did have trouble with using the telephone. And there's a wonderful story in this book by a fellow named Herbert Casson, who wrote an early history of the telephone. And he describes how when they first had telephones, they set them up on a stage in New York City. People would come up on stage. They became incredibly nervous. They would shout into the receiver, "Are you there? Are you there? Are you there? Can you hear me?" Kind of how people do with cell phones sometimes. But again, nobody knew how to use this new technology intuitively. So it required a certain amount of instruction.
So in spite of the billions of phone books that have been printed over the years, they've never been treated as worth preserving.
Almost never are they treated as something worth preserving. There are a couple of notable exceptions. My personal absolute favorite is a 1958 Cuban telephone directory, I think. And it was the last book before the Cuban Revolution. And inexplicably, somebody fleeing the Cuban Revolution decided they just had to take their telephone book with them. It's the only one of its kind, I think, and is currently in the archives at the University of Miami. And it's an enormously important document. And this is one of the things that I find so delightful about the telephone book, is that it's such an unemotional, comprehensive listing. How else are you going to have a record of all the stores that were in pre-revolutionary Cuba? This telephone book now is the most comprehensive record, in some respects, of what life was like at that time.
You know, it's interesting. In this era of portability, there is nothing less portable than the phone book. Does that mean that very soon it'll be a relic?
Well, I think it's a little bit hard to say. There's a certain section of the population that is really feels very strongly about keeping the white pages. In 2009 in Ohio, when they decided that AT&T didn't want to send the white pages out to everybody, they asked for permission from the public utilities to not do this. And they were told, well, it's fine. Just you have to take out an ad in the local newspaper saying you're only going to send out a telephone book if somebody asks for one. And so many people called up frantic or furious that they might not be getting their white pages that they actually crashed the AT&T call center.
Huh. But I do sense a real generational divide, because a lot of times when producers on this show can't find somebody, I'll say, did you try the phone book?
And yeah, there is a
there's a certain element of confusion when they look at me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it used to be an expression, look me up, I'm in the book. The telephone book used to just simply be referred to as the book.
Finally, let's ponder the existential element to the phone book. It's a mysterious compendium of countless existences, including your own. The late lamented memoirist Harvey Pekar described the wonder in that in one of his American Splendor comic books. Here's Paul Giamatti performing Harvey Pekar.
1960 was the year I got my first apartment and my first phone book. Now imagine my surprise when I looked up my name and saw that in addition to me, another Harvey Pekar was listed. Then in the 70s, I noticed that a third Harvey Pekar was listed in the phone book. What were they like, I thought? Where did it come from? What do they do? What's in a name? Who is Harvey Pekar?
I guess we'll just have to look elsewhere for confirmation that we exist.
In all the time I've spent looking through telephone books, I have not yet ever come across another Ammon Shea.
Ammon Shea, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ammon Shea is the author of The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads, just released from Peregrine Books. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Nerida Brownlee, Bonnie Watt, and Sarah Abdurrahman. and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was John Delore. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and the head that wears the crown. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by iContact, an email marketing firm based in North Carolina. Through its social responsibility program, iContact offers email marketing services to North Carolina-based nonprofits. Learn more at iContact.com/giving. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.